All right, let's pick up where we left off in the book of Zechariah, okay? If you need a Bible, there's one sitting over there on the coffee table. Okay, Zechariah, actually, he's been given by the Lord 10 different visions. And right now, we're going through his seventh and eighth vision, which picks up in chapter 5. Chapter 5, beginning with verse 1. This is actually his seventh of 10 visions. And he has two particular visions in this chapter 5. It's a short chapter. It's only 11 verses, but man, it covers so much ground. I just don't think that there's any way that I could possibly do it justice, you know, in just an hour and a half. As a matter of fact, you could just write volumes and volumes and volumes of what Zechariah has written here. And one of the things about Zechariah, the book of Zechariah is one of the most difficult books in the Old Testament because there's so much symbolism in it. But at the same token, I get a lot of inspiration from it because Zechariah was the prophet, was actually, his credentials were certified by Jesus himself, because if you remember when we went through the book of Matthew and also in the 11th chapter of the book of Luke, Jesus begins to condemn his generation for not heeding the prophets. And he condemned them, saying, you people say that, well, our fathers killed the prophets, but we would never have done that ourselves. And he says, you attest to the very fact that your fathers were murderers. And he says, I'm going to tell you right now that from the death of Abel all the way up to the death of to the murder of Zechariah, who was killed between the altar and the temple, he says, I'm going to lay the responsibility for the death of all these prophets on this particular generation. So, in other words, what I'm saying is Jesus mentioned Zechariah specifically as being a prophet. And so much of what he has to say is very profound in terms of the first and second coming of Christ, especially his second coming, and his eventual rule and reign over the whole world. And also it deals with a great deal in terms of judgments, the judgments upon the nations that are coming and the judgments upon individuals. But this chapter 5 is really unique to me because of the profound depth that it covers in so few verses. So what I want to do is actually it's in two parts because it's in two visions. We'll read the 11 verses, and then we'll go back and deal with the first vision, and then we'll get into the second vision, which gets into a great deal more detail. Beginning of verse 1, it says in chapter 5, then I lifted up my eyes and again looked, and behold, and there was a flying scroll. And he said to me, what do you see? And I answered, I see a flying scroll. Its length is 20 cubits, and its width is 10 cubits. Then he said to me, this is a curse that is going forth over the face of the whole land. Surely everyone who steals will be purged away according to the writing on one side, and everyone who swears will be purged away according to the writing on the other side. And I will make it go forth, declares the Lord of hosts, and it will enter the house of the thief and the house of the one who swears falsely by my name, and it will spend the night within that house and consume it with its timbers and stones. Then the angel who was speaking to me went out and said to me, lift up now your eyes and see what is going forth. And I said, what is it? And he said, this is the Ephah going forth. And he said, it is their appearance in all the land. And behold, a lead cover was lifted up, and this is a woman sitting inside the Ephah. And he said, this is wickedness. And he threw her down into the middle of the Ephah and cast the lead weight on its opening. Then I lifted my eyes and looked, and there were two women who were coming out with the wind in their wings, and they had wings like the wings of a stork, and they lifted up the Ephah between the earth and the heavens. And I said to the angel who was speaking with me, where are they taking the Ephah? And he said to me, to build a temple for her in the land of Shinar, and when it is prepared, she will be set there on her own pedestal. Okay, let's back up to the first verse in this chapter 5, and let's deal with the first part of this vision, which happens to be a flying scroll. Okay, he says, then I lifted my eyes and again and looked, and behold, there was a flying scroll. And like I said, he almost goes from one trance to another in terms of these visions that are taking place. But God is I think, really trying to emphasize through his word, through his prophet, through the symbolism that's involved here, just how vivid and how accurate and how dependable and how you can just count on it, bank on it, that when God says he's going to do something, he's going to do it. Okay? And it's interesting what he deals with here, because in verse 2 he says, "And he said to me," the angel said to me, "what do you see?" And I answered, I said, "I see a flying scroll, and its length is 20 cubits and its width is 10 cubits." He sees this scroll and it's flying through the air. And it's obviously it's opened up because he said he can see the dimensions of it. It's 10 cubits by 20 cubits. And not only that, he says he can see writing on both sides of it. Okay? Then he says in verse 3, "And he said to me, this is the curse that is going forth over the face of the whole land. Surely everyone who steals will be purged away according to the writing on one side, and everyone who swears will be purged away according to the writing on the other side. And I will make it go forth, declares the Lord of hosts, and it will enter the house of the thief and the house of the one who swears falsely by my name, and it will spend the night within that house and consume it with its timbers and stones." Okay, just you know, breaking this down, what we're dealing with here is first of all, like I said, this is the seventh of ten visions. It's a flying scroll, and he sees its dimensions. And I think that the dimensions are really significant to me, because first of all, he says that this represents a curse that's going to come upon, you know, specific people. First of all, the very specific people who steal and those who swear falsely. And what he means by swear falsely, of course, is those who swear by other gods, okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know the first commandment says, "I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt not have the strange gods before me." But also, the third commandment, and it depends on what book you're looking at. If you look in Exodus, there's a certain order. In Deuteronomy, there's a certain order. I usually go by Deuteronomy, but in Exodus, you know, you see an order where the third one says, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain." Well, to take God's name in vain just doesn't mean you know, just simply punctuating a sentence with his name. Okay? It means that you could take his name in vain by simply by acknowledging him, and yet at the same time, you're doing what? You're swearing falsely. In other words, you're not committed to him. This is this nation in a nutshell. I mean, every one of our darn dollar bills we got in God we trust, right? But isn't that a crock of baloney? I mean, do we trust God? No. You know, we've kicked him out of our schools and out of our courts, out of our judicial system, out of our institutions. You know, we've done nothing more than reduced him to some kind of cuddly mascot that's just simply, you know, make you feel good. Okay? You can say at the end of your speech, at the end of your sermon, "God bless you," or whatever. But so how many people in this country are swearing falsely by his name? Okay? And then those, how many people swear? I mean, how many people are steal? Okay? So what you got here is you got a curse that's going forth, and it's really the encumberment of all the commandments. And the reason I say that is because, first of all, what did Jesus say was the greatest commandment? And somebody said to him, "Lord, what is the greatest commandment?" He says, "The greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with your whole heart, mind, soul, and strength." And then he said,
"Love your neighbor."
And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. So, when you got a situation where this curse is going forth throughout all the land, when it means all the land, it means all the earth. Does anybody else Bible say all the earth? In other words, it's not just going to be Israel. It's all men. For everyone who steals and everyone who swears falsely, this is a curse that's going forth. But what it represents here is it represents the entire commandments, all of them, because it represents two phases, two classes. In other words, one has to deal with our relationship with God. The other one has to deal with our relationship with men. If we swear falsely by God's name, it's our relationship with him that's going to bring a curse, right? And if we steal from our fellow man, okay, it's going to bring a curse as well. Why? Because these two commandments, stealing and swearing falsely, actually represent the entire law. They are basically almost in the, if you can imagine yourself, the two tablets of the Ten Commandments, five on each one, they're basically in the middle of each one of the tablets. They cover the whole law, because Jesus said, the greatest commandment, love God with your whole heart, mind, soul, and strength. Second commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. This is a violation of both of them, isn't it? So when this curse is going forth, first of all, he says it's a flying scroll. Now, it didn't say it had wings on it, but I put wings on this thing. I don't know. But the fact that it's flying suggests what? Well, yeah. Yeah. What it suggests here is that it's going forth with great speed. Okay? It doesn't just have legs. It is moving at great speed. In other words,
There's a curse that's coming upon all men. As a matter of fact, it's, you know, whenever we break God's law, there's a curse that's involved. And when you go through the book of Deuteronomy, there's a list of all the blessings that will happen to us that will overtake us. I like the word he uses, because he uses it. If we do certain things, God says that blessings will eventually overtake us. To overtake us simply means that it will come from behind, come from, you know, and overtake you without you expecting it, a blessing. But at the same time, he says that a curse will overtake those who violate his law. Okay? So at the same, so we're in a situation, okay, that we might feel like, hey, I've been stealing for years and years and years and years. I've never got caught. I've never been to jail. I've never been to prison. Nothing that ever happened to me. I got a whole house full of stolen goods, and I'm, you know, you, we could think of ourselves like this, right? But such a person who thinks that way doesn't realize how swiftly this curse is coming upon him. I mean, this is one thing about motion. I've mentioned this before. Motion is the great deceiver. It's almost like the faster something goes, the less apparent it is. Okay? Like our galaxy right now is traveling like 1.5 million miles per hour. I mean, nobody feels it. Our world right now is spinning on its axis 1,000 miles an hour. We're hurtling through space at over 37,000 miles an hour. Do you feel it? Do you sense it? You know what I'm saying? Okay?
Stop!
Our solar system is moving at thousands and thousands of miles an hour. Everything is in motion. That desk right there is in, alive with the dance of the atoms. Everything is in motion. But see, we don't see it. We don't recognize it. And that's the same thing with the curse that will come upon those who violate God's law. It is already in motion. And we don't realize how quickly it can come upon us. All right? But what you've got here is, I think, is very significant, because he gives it the dimensions. He says that the dimensions are 20 cubits by 10 cubits. And I think that's very significant, because that's the same dimension. 20 cubits by 10 cubits is actually 30 feet long and 15 feet wide. That's a big scroll. 30 feet long, 15 feet wide. But that's the same exact dimensions of the Holy and Holies of the tabernacle. So in other words, what we've got here is a symbolism that suggests to us that God is going to judge us by his standards of measurements, not man's. His standards. When you've got the same dimensions as that of the Holy of Holies, as his scroll, what it strongly suggests is that, hey, God is going to judge us, and he's going to punish us according to his standard of righteousness, his standard of goodness. See, we've got such a wretched, low opinion of God and of sin and of holiness and of righteousness. We just think that we're basically good if we don't go running around mass murdering people. But God's whole standard of righteousness is totally different. And if we don't measure up to that standard, there's going to be a curse. Now, I recognize that none of us can live it up to it. That's why Jesus took this curse for himself, on himself, for us who couldn't. But we've got to put on his righteousness, and therefore what? Start living for him. Have his Holy Spirit live through us so that we don't do what? We don't swear falsely, and we don't go around stealing. You know, I've said this before, and I've written about it, but I've often thought to myself, if we just kept one commandment in the world, just that one commandment, thou shalt not steal, just the one, if everybody in the world kept it in the letter and in the spirit of the law, this would be a utopia. Overnight, it would become a utopia, wouldn't it? Can you imagine how wonderful the world would be if just everybody kept the one commandment? You see, that's why this commandment is so important. And that's why it brings upon man such a curse. But it represents our relationship with men in every area. Also, the one that says, he who swears falsely, represents our relationship with God. So what you got here, like I said, is a situation where we are actually measured by God's standard of righteousness and holiness. And I just wrote here, the two commandments are specifically mentioned, stealing, the eighth commandment, and swearing falsely in the name of Jehovah, that's the third commandment. They are the middle commandments of the two tablets of stone representing the entire law. The first having to do with man's relationship to God, and the second having to do with man's relationship with his fellow man.
the first and the second greatest commandments. And then God says this, that he said, I bring it forth, and it shall enter into the house, and it, men cannot hide their sins. Okay? When God says he's going to bring this curse, and it's going to reside in their house, and it's going to reside within the timbers and stones in their house, what you see is a situation where if a person steals, okay, he brings a curse upon himself. He may not see it right away, okay, but it's actually his whole household becomes cursed. And he says this curse is going to rest within the timbers and stones of the person's house. The Bible says, hey, be sure your sin will find you out. We may think to ourselves in the confines of our own house, in the privacy and the secrecy of our own household, nobody's going to see, nobody's going to know. But this curse is going to dwell, abide on this particular household.
John, tell it New York story about the burglars.
Why don't you tell it? Okay,
you don't remember?
Okay, well, what happened was there was this true incident in New York where this this Christian family, the father went out to work early in the morning, and I think three or four guys entered this household, and it was a Christian household, and they were, you know, going to vandalize the place, rob the place, and they go into this little boy's room, and this little boy was trying to open his eyes. He couldn't open his eyes. You ever had that? And you had that kind of situation where he couldn't open his eyes, and he didn't know why. And he asked his mother later on that day. He says, "You know, I was trying to open my eyes this morning, and my eyes wouldn't open. I couldn't open." He says, "Well, you were probably just dreaming." But then this household got a letter from this guy who was actually in the house, broken into the house, and he confessed what he had done. He said that they were in the house going to rob it, and they went into this little boy's room, and they had a gun, and they had it pointed at the boy, and they were going to shoot the boy if he opened up, if he woke up. If he woke up. He said, but when they were in there, they saw this huge angel. He said it was about 8 or 9 feet tall. And the angel had his hand over the boy's eyes, and the angel said to the four of them, he says, "You are under a curse of God. You leave this house immediately to never come back." And they went flying out of that house, two of them were killed in various ways. Killed in a different way, and another one, I don't know if he went to prison or something, but this guy wrote this letter to this family, and he says he apologized, and as a matter of fact, I have the letters, but I won't get into that right now. I'm just trying to say that...
He wanted to confess all the sin to the woman and tell her everything that happened because he felt that he was under a curse, and so that's how the story came out. Yeah.
Anyway, it was it kind of goes along with what we're talking about as far as this curse is concerned. And, you know, God was obviously protecting this particular household. Okay, isn't this what Jesus kind of said too? I don't want to get off on a real tangent, but he talked about when he sent forth his disciples two by two, and he basically said, and you go into a house, you know, if the house is worthy of your blessing will remain. If not, your blessing will come back upon you. So in other words, you go into a house, if a household is committed to Christ, committed to God, okay, that household, there's a blessing there, okay? And a person who comes in the name of the Lord, if that household is worthy, that household will receive a further blessing, okay? But if the household not worthy, in other words, if the household is, an idolatrous household, an immoral household, a household that's full of, you know, stolen goods, drugs, and whatnot, well, you know, there's a curse on that house. And simply because a person may try to bless the house, it ain't going to work. Because why? There's a curse on the household itself. In other words, I'm getting off here, but what I wanted to point out is the fact that this curse resides in a person's possessions and his household. Okay? And in the book of Exodus, we are told that God says he's a jealous God, visiting the iniquities of the fathers upon their children up to the second and third generation. You know what that means?
Their son will. The curse will be on the son and the grandson.
Right. Okay. Let me explain it a little further.
Whatever. Yeah.
And it's all a matter. We may think to ourselves, well, gee, that's not fair. That doesn't seem right. Let's say that the curse would go on from generation to generation. But just let me just put it this way. We've heard the old adage, like father, like son, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if your father, let's say, is a no-good-for-nothing drunk, an abuser, an alcoholic, a thief, an immoral person, what kind of son do you think he's going to have? Basically the same. Okay?
Or the exact opposite.
Well, I mean, okay, it's true. I mean, we are told that in Ezekiel too, but as a whole, in general, what you're going to find is like father, like son. It's going to be passed on from generation to generation. Now, a person can break that cycle by accepting Christ, okay, and turning it all around. But basically what I'm saying is it's passed on. That kind of curse is passed on. Okay, simply because of the lifestyle. Same thing, the opposite is true too in terms of blessing. So what we're dealing with here, we're dealing with a God who is a holy God, a righteous God, that at the same token we've got to understand that unless we repent of our sins, we are residing under a curse and in a curse. Okay, anybody have any questions on that particular vision? I didn't want to spend a lot of time on that simply because that when we get into the next one, it really gets it involved, because what we need to do now is we're going to read this about this, his next vision, beginning with verse 5 through 11. But then we're going to have to move from here over to Revelation chapter 18 to kind of tie it in together, because what Zechariah is now seeing in symbolism is what's going to happen to Babylon. All right. Let's just read it real quick. Verse 5, it says, "Then the angel who was speaking with me went out and said to me, 'Lift up now your eyes and see what is going forth.' And I said, 'What is it?' And he said, 'This is the FF going forth.' He said, 'This is their appearance in all the land. And behold, the lead cover was lifted up, and this is a woman sitting inside the FF. And he said, "This is wickedness." And he threw her down into the middle of the FF and cast the lead weight on her, on its opening. Then I lifted my eyes and looked, and there were two women who were coming out with the wind in their wings, and they had wings like the wings of a stork, and lifted up the FF between the earth and the heavens. And I said to the angel who was speaking with me, 'Where are they taking the FF?' Then he said to me, 'To build a temple for her in the land of Shinar, and when it is prepared, she will be set there on her own pedestal.'" Okay, now, what I think we need to do is, everybody turn their Bibles to the 18th chapter of the book of Revelation, okay, because this has its fulfillment in what's going to happen in the end times. Now, this all has to deal with Babylon, or the Babylon being rebuilt and Babylon being destroyed. Now, when you read in the book of Revelation, you read it two types of Babylon. There's the Babylon, the mother of harlots, which is a spiritual harlot. Okay, there's a judgment that's pronounced upon her in the 17th chapter of Revelation. But this 18th chapter of Revelation has to deal with a specific city. Okay, and I just want to share with you a couple things before we even begin reading it. Babylon, anybody know where Babylon is located? Babylon is located in modern-day Iraq. And it's been Saddam Hussein who has actually been responsible for the rebuilding of Babylon. Now, Babylon has laid in ruins for centuries. Okay, there's a book out, it's called The Rise of Babylon by this Charles Dyer. Okay. And he gets a lot of useful information as far as what's happening as far as this Babylon is concerned. I'll just read you a few excerpts here before we get into reading what happens, what we're going to read in Revelation and tie it in with Zechariah. But on October 11th, 1990, this was a newspaper clipping out of the New York Times. It says that under President Saddam Hussein, one of the ancient world's most legendary cities has begun to rise again. More than an archaeological venture, the new Babylon is self-consciously dedicated to the idea that Nebuchadnezzar has a successor in Mr. Hussein, whose military prowess and vision will restore the Iraqis and their glory, the glory their ancestors knew when all of what was now Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Kuwait, and Israel was under Babylonian control. Okay, just a couple things that it says in this book. But as of February 1990, over 60 million bricks have been laid in reconstruction of Nebuchadnezzar's fabled city. Saddam Hussein has ignored the objections of archaeologists who considered it a crime to build over an ancient ruins. He has scrapped the plan to rebuild Babylon on a nearby site across the Euphrates River. On the exact opposite of, on the exact site of ancient Babylon, he has reconstructed the southern palace of Nebuchadnezzar, including the procession street, a Greek theater, many temples, what was once Nebuchadnezzar's throne room, and half-scale size model of the Ishtar Gate. It goes on to say that Saddam Hussein plans to rebuild the Hanging Gardens, which were once considered one of the seven wonders of the world, and he has offered $1.5 million prize to any Iraqi who can devise a plan to irrigate the gardens using only the technology available in ancient Babylon. Three artificial hills, each almost 100 feet high, have been built on the plain and planted with the palm trees and vines, and the ziggurat, the Tower of Babel, may once again rise over the city. Okay. Also, a couple more things before we get into reading Revelation. It says the restoration of Babylon began in 1978 to save what remained of the city from the destruction of destructive effects of local salt deposits, high water tables, and the pillaging from local villages. In part because most young Iraqi men were away at the war with Iran, and in part because native laborers often lacked the required skills, Babylon has largely been rebuilt through the hands of over 1,800 Egyptians, Sudanese, Chinese, and South Korean laborers. Also, says the President Hussein has signed an open check to reconstruct the ancient city and revive the marvelous shape it had had before the Persian aggression, which destroyed it more than 20 centuries ago. A couple more notes. It says the city of Babylon was a supreme visual aid. It became an Iraqi Alamo or Masada. So Saddam Hussein is determined that he's going to rebuild this particular city. And there's a lot of pictures here as far as it being rebuilt. The Bible predicted, okay, that it would come into prominence in the last days. All right? It's laid in ruins for centuries. Nobody could imagine it ever being restored. But you think to yourself, certainly politically, it would seem like one of the worst places in the world to have what the Bible refers to as basically the center of economic activity. But everything's going to fall into place real shortly. And when it does, what we're going to see is Babylon is going to become basically the new Wall Street. That seems almost impossible to imagine, given the scenario that we have today, as far as the political unrest in the Middle East, as far as the Saddam Hussein, as far as everything that's going on there. Okay, but rest assured that Babylon is already being rebuilt, because a couple of things about Babylon. Babylon never experienced a violent overthrow. The prophets predicted that she would be violently overthrown like Sodom and Gomorrah. The prophets foretold that she would be destroyed in a very, very merciless way. Babylon never experienced that. When Babylon was overtaken by the Medes and the Persians, or King Cyrus, if you remember reading in the book of Daniel, it was Belshazzar. Remember, he was having a drunken orgy, and then this hand comes writing on the wall, "Meeny, meeny, tekel, upharsin." Nobody could interpret it, but Daniel came in and said to Belshazzar, the king, he says, "What this is telling you is that you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. You've been weighed in the scales and found wanting. That Babylon will now be divided among the Medes and the Persians. And this very night, it's going to happen to you." Well, what happened was that there was never any violent overthrow. When the Medes and the Persians took Babylon, they actually took it by diverting the river, the ford of the river, which Isaiah predicted over 100 years before it happened. They went in underneath the city, through the riverbed. They captured the city, and a lot of people within the city didn't even know that it had been taken or captured for 3 or 4 days. They didn't know it. And then it never experienced the violent overthrow that the prophets had foretold, but it will in the very near future. Okay, so let's just read this chapter 18. It's a lengthy chapter. I'm not going to do a lot of, I'm not going to do a lot of commenting on this particular chapter, but we need to read it, because I just share with you how Babylon is now already in the process of being rebuilt. It doesn't seem possible that would ever become a situation where the Bible describes it actually becomes the economic hub of the entire world. But it will soon rise to that promise. So when we're dealing with this chapter 18, we're dealing with a specific city here. And the city is obviously is referred to as Babylon. Beginning with verse 1, it says in 18 of Revelation, it says, after these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. And she has become a dwelling place of demons, and a prison of every unclean bird, and a prison of every unclean, hateful bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passions of her immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her sins, that you may not receive of her plagues. For her sins have piled up high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back even as she has been paid. Give her back to her double according to her deeds, and the cup which she has mixed twice as much for her. To the degree that she has glorified herself and lived sensuously, to the same degree give her torment and mourning. For she says in her heart, I sit as a queen, I am not a widow, and I will never see mourning. For this reason, in one day her plagues will come upon her, pestilence and mourning and famine, and she will be burned up with fire, for the Lord God who judges her is strong. And the kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensuously with her will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance because of the fear of her torment, saying, woe, woe, the great city of Babylon, the strong city, for in one hour your judgment has come. And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn over her because no one buys her cargoes anymore, cargoes of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and every kind of citron wood and every article of ivory and every article made from very costly wood and bronze and iron and marble and cinnamon and spice and incense and perfume and frankincense and wine and olive oil and fine flour and wheat and cattle and sheep and cargoes of horses and chariots and slaves and human lives. And the fruit of you, and the fruit you long for has gone from you, and all the things that were luxurious and splendid have passed away from you, and men will no longer find them. The merchants of these things who became rich from her will stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment, weeping and mourning, saying, woe, woe, the great city, she who is clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in one hour with such great wealth has been laid waste, and every shipmate and every passenger and sailor and many as make their living by the sea stood at a distance and were crying out as they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is like this great city? And they threw dust in their heads and were crying out, weeping and mourning, saying, woe, woe, the great city in which all who have had ships at sea became rich by her wealth, for in one hour she has been laid waste. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her. And a strong angel took a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, thus will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence, and not be found any longer, and the sound of the harpist and the musicians and the flute player and the trumpet tears will not be heard in you any longer, and no craftsman or any craft will be found in you any longer, and the sound of a mill will not be heard in you any longer, and the light of a lamp will not shine in you any longer, and the voice of the bridegroom and bride will not be heard in you any longer, for your merchants were the great men of the earth, because of all the nations were deceived by your sorcery. And in her was found the blood of the prophets and of the saints and all who have been slain on the earth. Okay, now let's back up, okay? Let's back up to Zechariah and just go through this now. Like I said, this is covering an awful lot of ground, and we're only dealing with the latter part of this chapter 5, which actually only is about 6 or 7 verses. And he says in that verse 5, says, the angel was speaking to me, with me went out and said to me, lift up your eyes and see what is this going forth. And I said, what is it? And he said, this is the FF going forth. And he said, this is the appearance to all the land. Okay, now what we're dealing with here is we're dealing with Babylon. As far as the city goes, it represents actually worldliness. It represents the love of the world. Who remembers what the love of the world represents? According to John. Love of the world is, yeah.
lust, the love of the world.
Pride of life.
Yeah, the lust, the love of the world basically equals this: the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and pride of life. Okay, that's what's referred to as the love of the world. Okay, and what Zechariah is seeing, I don't know if you could see this very well, but what he's seeing is a very significant, okay, because he sees his vision, and he sees this big basket. It's called an ephah, and I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right, but it's one of the largest of the Hebrew measures, okay? It's a dry measure. It's a basket they would use for commerce, okay, for buying, trading, selling. They would use it. They would put grain or whatever, wheat or whatever it is. They would use it in the marketplace as a means of commerce. So what this basket represents is, in the worldly sense, what we just read in Revelation. What we just read in Revelation, there was this long, long, long list of what? All of these goods and these articles, these material things, okay, that all symbolize what? Money or wealth or, a mammon. Anybody remember what mammon is? God, Jesus said, God cannot serve God and mammon. That's what Jesus said.
Money.
Mammon is wealth, it's money, it's material things, okay? He says you can't serve God and mammon. He says you're either going to love one or despise the other, cling to one or hold the other. In other words, you get in a situation where money, material things, the lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, pride of life, these type of things will come between us and God every time if we do not make a concerted effort to put God first in our life. People do this constantly and they don't even realize it. They give God head acknowledgement. They acknowledge God. They go to church, or they belong to they're members of a church, and they've been baptized, or they make some kind of mental assent to Jesus Christ. But where is their heart? Jesus says, "Where your treasure lies, so lies your heart." Is your heart in your piggy bank? Okay, is it in your money? Is it in your stocks? Is it in your bonds? Where is our heart? Okay. Is it sold out to Christ, or is it really sold out to the world as far as material things, as far as money? There's nothing wrong with material things. There's nothing wrong with money in and of itself. But remember, when Jesus gave the parable of the sower of the seed, he said that some seeds fell among thistles and thorns. What did he say represented the thistles and thorns?
The cares
of the world and the deceitfulness of riches can choke out a person's spiritual life. In other words, it can happen without us really even realizing it. Okay, we fail to do what? We fail to read the Bible, go to Bible study, go to prayer groups, go to church. You know, we get along with God in prayer and do good works and so on and so forth. Why? Because we're too busy, what? Trying to make a living or trying to buy another speedboat, another motorcycle, another house, another car, another this, another that. I mean, you know, so that in the very end, Jesus can say to you, well done, now fool, you know, you've collected the most junk and you've died with it. Now what are you going to do with it? Okay, this is what happens to people. They don't even realize what's taking place in their life because they're so preoccupied with what? The things of the world. Okay, the things that God has given us to enjoy in the world. I don't care whether they're houses or cars or whatever. These things are all material things that must be subject to our relationship with Christ. If any of these things come before God, they become our God. Okay. So what you see here is you see this basket representing commerce, representing money, representing mammon. And what you see in it is you see a woman. Now, why did he use the term, why did he say a woman? And he said this woman represents what? He said this woman is what?
Wickedness.
Wickedness. Yeah. Now, why would he use a woman to symbolize wickedness? This is very important.
Don't
okay.
I don't know. She likes
a shop. No. Oh. Hey, that could.
Just
no.
Kidding.
Okay. Let me just read something from James, okay? He says, "What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is it not the source of your pleasures that wage war with your members?" He says, "Now listen, you lust and you do not have. So you commit murder. And you are envious and cannot obtain. So you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask, and you ask and do not receive because you ask with the wrong motive so that you may spend it on your own pleasures." Now listen, you adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility or enmity towards God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. In other words, if you go back in the Old Testament, Israel was referred to time and time and time and time again as the wife of Jehovah. God uses
God sees his people in the feminine gender in terms of this is my people, they are his wife. In the New Testament, Jesus refers to his church as his bride. So when you see a situation where you have a woman representing wickedness, what you see is this becomes an adulteress. This woman, the woman actually represents someone who's become, this woman here, excuse me, has become a seducer in the sense that she has seduced our affections away from God. Am I making any sense to you?
Yeah.
Happy yes. You look like you're sleeping.
No.
Okay. So that's why he uses the term woman, because this is the sense, this is the, like, you see how this woman seduces us from our relationship with God, the way it's supposed to be. Money will do it every time, won't it? Because what are we told in Timothy? Okay, we are told that the love of money is what? The root of all sorts of evil. Okay? The love of money, not money in and of itself. But if we have an inordinate love for money, okay, let's face it, there's not a sin known to man that he will not commit for money. Right?
At some price, yeah.
Yeah. See what I'm saying? So this is why he says this represents wickedness, because, okay, it is what has seduced men throughout the ages. Isn't that what we were just reading in Revelation? How she has seduced the kings of the earth through immorality. Well, we're talking about immorality. It's not talking about sexual immorality. It's talking about the spiritual immorality that men have been engaged in terms of their relationship with God. They have been seduced by this woman. Okay? In terms of their relationship with God. So, what you see here, okay, is you see that he sees this FF going forth. He says it's lifted up between heaven and earth. That's pretty significant. Why? Who? Okay, men are looking up. This is something that men look up to. Money.
Looks down on it.
Who looks down on it? God.
God, yeah.
What is obscured from men's view?
The woman.
God.
God.
Because of the woman.
They can't
right.
See?
So you got a situation where it's lifted up, but now he said it's going forth. Okay? And what he says is he says that there's this lead cover of this woman. He opens the cover, the woman is there, but then he says, this woman is wickedness. He takes the woman and he throws her down. What does that signify?
Destroying
her? What it signifies is...
not acceptable?
Is, huh?
It's not acceptable?
Yeah. What it symbolizes is basically God's contempt for this woman. Okay? It's God's contempt for what men hold most dear. The money and material things that they put so dearly before God and other men. Right? God holds it in contempt. Men elevate it to an idol. God holds it in contempt. He throws it down. But then he said he puts this lead cover over it. That's kind of significant as far as this lead cover. A lead cover obviously is something that really constrains. All right? What is suggested to me, okay, there's a couple things that could be suggested. But this woman is constrained because she has a destination to go to for a particular judgment. And that destination is Shinar. Who remembers where Shinar is? Shinar is the ancient name for Babylon. You go back into the book of Genesis, and what you read about in the book of Genesis, you read about a man by the name of Nimrod. Okay, he built this huge tower known as the Tower of Babel on the plains of Shinar. That is the ancient name for Babylon. That was the beginning of harlotries, where he built this huge, massive tower. Now, he wasn't trying to build this tower to go into outer space or into God's throne room. He wasn't stupid. What his intention was is that particular time, all the men and women of the world spoke one language. And so, rather than Nimrod was their king, he wanted to be in control of everybody. He didn't want anybody dispersed all out there. So he wanted to build this one huge, massive superstructure that would unite them as a people. And the superstructure would be used by the priest at that particular time as an observation tower for the stars. It was the beginning of astrology. That's why they refer to Babylon as being the mother of harlots. It was at Babylon that the idolatries began to take place, as far as the men beginning to turn their back on God for what? She is the mother of harlots in terms of all false doctrine, all the cults, all these false gods, false deities, false beliefs, false religious systems, as well as the mother of all that stands before God as hateful in terms of the love of money, the lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, the pride of life. It all had its origin in Shinar, which is the ancient name for Babylon. Well, this FF is going forth back to Shinar, where it began. We were just reading about that, weren't we? How Saddam Hussein is rebuilding Babylon. Well, it's going back to its destination, which is in China. Okay. Interesting what he says is he says that he puts this lead cover over it, constraining it, meaning that, okay, let's face it, Babylon has laid in ruins for how long? 20 centuries. Well, they were conquered 20 centuries ago. Okay, let me just give you a quick background as far as Babylon is concerned. The city of Babylon was captured in 541 BC by Cyrus, who was mentioned by name 125 years before he was born by Isaiah in Isaiah 44. Also, some years later, the city revolted against Darius, but after after 20 months of fruitless siege, it was taken by strategy, but not destroyed. That was in 516 BC. And in 331 BC, Alexander the Great came against Babylon to conquer it, but rather than conquering it and destroying it, the people just opened up the gates, welcoming in with open arms, so the city wasn't destroyed. And in 293 BC, the Selyukid kings built the capital for himself in the neighborhood of the Babylon city, which became the rival city, which eventually drew the inhabitants from Babylon. In other words, back in about 300 BC, there was a trade shift. Babylon was located between the Euphrates and Tigris River, and there was a city that was built on the Tigris River instead of the Euphrates. Babylon's by the Euphrates River, and so what happened was that it was a slow decline of the city, just simply through the trade route. Also, in 60 AD, I think this is kind of significant. 60 years after Christ, the Apostle Peter was working among the Jews there, for it was from Babylon that Peter wrote his first epistle. If you remember, he said from Babylon, okay? And then, if you remember, he said, from Babylon. And then in the 5th century, it was the only inhabited by Jews. Matter of fact, there was a couple of mosques there. And in 917 AD, it was an insignificant village, but still existed. In 1898, it continued. It was basically uncovered by archaeologists as far as, you know, its ruins were concerned. And now it's being rebuilt. Okay, what I'm saying is it's been constrained all these years. But now it's going to come back. Because what he said, he's going to Shinar, where there's going to be a temple built for her. Meaning what? I mean, it's going to be actually a situation where Babylon is going to rise to prominence again, and she's going to become the economic powerhouse of the world. Okay, a couple things to keep in mind. All right? Okay, Babylon, the great city, the capital. It was the capital of the world under Nimrod. It dominated the world under Nebuchadnezzar. It was conquered by the Medes and Persians in 539 BC, but it will be rebuilt. It is the epitome of godless materialism. It is a breeding ground for every form of greed. Okay, the blood of all the prophets and the saints are going to be laid at the foot of this city. It is a city that in the end times. It says here, we just read in Revelation, that it is filled with every kind of hateful bird and unclean bird. In other words, in the end time, when it will be rebuilt, I mean, it's already rebuilt, but when it becomes occupied, this the center hub of the world, it's going to be occupied by every form of demon and devil imaginable.
That's what it means when it talks about the birds.
The hateful birds, right? It's going to be the center of occultism, of false religion, of cultic practices, of Satan worship, all of these different things. Okay. Okay. What he says here is, he says that the FF is going forth, but he says he sees two women who are going to carry it away, and they have the wind to their wings, and their wings are like the wings of storks. What's significant about their wings? If you go back in the book of Leviticus, God lists this whole long litany of things that are clean and unclean. Things you could eat, things you couldn't eat, right? One of the unclean things was storks, okay? Now, we may think to ourselves, why did God go through this whole long list of all of the... You could eat certain animals, you could eat certain birds, you could eat certain fish, and you could eat certain insects, but you couldn't eat others. God always classified them as being clean and unclean, right? Well, we know today, for example, they were not allowed to eat pork, okay? God said that you could eat an animal that divided the hoof and chewed the cud, like a cow. But if it just divided the hoof but didn't chew the cud like a pig, you couldn't eat it. Now, the whole litany of things that he listed, he wasn't trying to give him a diet to live by. He was actually going much further. What it really symbolizes is what God was trying to build into them, a discernment, you know, an understanding of what's clean and unclean spiritually. Okay, certain things we feed on can be healthy for us. Certain things we feed on can be very poisonous to us, or to our system, or deadly to us. Same thing spiritually. You want to feed your mind on God's word. Okay, Jesus said that every word, the man does not live on bread alone, but every word that proceeded from the mouth of God. Okay, this is what we're going to live by spiritually. Okay, but you want to feed your mind on pornography. Okay, you want to feed your mind on the boob tube. You want to feed your mind on things that are just totally in the world. What's going to happen? There are certain things that are clean and unclean. Certain things that are going to have a detrimental effect to our life or a very positive effect in our life. That's what God was trying to get his people to understand when he gave them those dietary laws. Well, one of the things that we've classified as being unclean were storks. Okay? It says that these women, now here we've got women's again. So what's that suggest this? They're not angelic beings. The reason I say they're not angelic beings is because always in the Bible, angels are mentioned in the masculine, never in the feminine. Okay? I know people say that, well, they're women angels. I kind of disagree with that simply because the scriptures, there's always mentioned in the masculine form. So when you see it in the women's form, okay, it's symbolizing something else. Again, this is a divine, this is a mission, but it's not from God. It said they have wings of a stork, meaning that it is a defiling mission. It's a satanic mission. It says it has the wind to their wings. What does that suggest?
Going quickly.
Okay, we are told in the New Testament, of course, that the Holy Spirit is Jesus referred to as being like the wind, okay? But at the same token, we are told in Ephesians 2:2, that the wind, that Satan is the prince of the power of air, or spirit. We are told that he is the god of this world, he's the prince of the power of air. So in other words, that what we see is demonic forces that are behind the reestablishment of this city in Babylon that's going to become the economic trade center of the world. Okay? And it's moving swiftly. It's just moving right along, even though it's constrained at this particular time. Okay? But when it does arrive, and we can already see the groundwork being laid for it, it's going to be an overnight situation. Okay? Let me just read you some of the things that I've written here, okay? Matter of fact, this is an article out of the Sacramento Bee. It was at September 17th in 1989. This is, you know, eight years ago. It says, this is what the article said. Quote, talk about a blast from the past. Songs written 6,000 years ago will be performed in the fabled city of Babylon, as it relives the ancient days when it was the center of civilization. It says tens of thousands of people are expected at the huge cultural extravaganza starting Friday in Babylon. The city was rebuilt by the President Saddam Hussein of Iraq in the program to revive the splendors of the past and to build a tourist industry following the 8-year Persian Gulf War. Okay, that was back 8-9 years ago. All right?
couple things about a stork that I got out of the dictionary or the encyclopedia. It says the wings of a stork, it says, unclean bird feeds upon reptiles, rodents, and insects. It says, stork knows her seasons. We are told that in Job 8:7. And there are 17 different species worldwide of storks. They have long legs, necks, and bills, and usually inhabit open places, open plains, like China. Okay, well, and it says that a pair of storks will return to the same nest year after year.
Also, you know, you get that legend of the stork delivering babies. Why did that kind of fable come into being? Anybody know?
Basically, because a stork is notorious or known for caring very much for her young. And so you see a situation where these two women have the wings of the stork. Or in other words, the demonic forces behind this worldly event, worldly element, okay, is going to do everything possible to nurture it into being or nurture it back into being. We already see it, of course, in the spirit of the world as far as lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, pride of life. But it's all going to be epitomized in this one city. Okay? Now, I want to go over with you a couple things about Babylon, because when we tie it into this chapter 18, I think it's going to make, I think, a lot more sense. First of all, let me just tell you what the old city of Babylon was like, okay? Because I got this out, this is described by Herodias. The old city, I mean, you know, the original city, it was exactly 15 miles square, 60 miles in circumference. It's surrounded by a brick wall, 87 feet thick and about 350 feet high. It was probably more like 100. I don't know if this guy was right on that. I think the archaeological finds for it find that it was more like 100 feet high. It says, and on the walls were 250 towers, and the top of the walls were wide enough to drive 6 chariots abreast. Outside the wall was a deep ditch or a moat surrounding the city. Inside the wall was another wall, a secondary defense. Its 25 used avenues, 150 feet wide, ran from north to south inside the wall. It also was divided in two parts by the river that ran through it. It's the city has had actually, you know, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, the Hanging Gardens of actually Nebuchadnezzar's Hanging Gardens. There was one of the 7 wonders of the world. Anyway, there's a lot of different information about this. Okay, this city was virtually impregnable. It was, its walls were so high, they were so thick, it was just, you couldn't get in the city. But Isaiah predicted 125 years before its fall, before it was captured, that the fords of the river would be turned away. And that's what the armies of the Medes and the Persians did. And it was predicted in the Bible that they would do it. They actually took the river, they dammed it up. And see, this moat that went through, I mean, see, this river that ran through it, it wasn't the river itself, it was a diversion from the river that ran to the city. So what they did is they cut off that diversion, dried up the water running through it, and they just crawled underneath the riverbed to get into the city. And they also bribed some of the gatekeepers to open the gates. So it was kind of like the walls did them absolutely no good. Okay, but then now the thing has been laid in ruins, but it's going to come back into prominence. And these are a couple of things I think that are worth mentioning or recognizing when we're dealing with this chapter 18, is that John says this, after these things I saw another angel. And then it said this angel that comes down, he says, this angel, he illuminates the world with his presence. Okay? This angel that comes down out of heaven to deal specifically with his judgment of Babylon. Well, he illuminates the world. I think that's kind of significant because the world is steeped in such tremendous spiritual darkness, blackness. And the darker something is, the more illuminating a light becomes. And this angel's presence just illuminates the world as he comes down to mete out judgment against Babylon. This angel also has great authority, it's obvious. And he says he cried out with a mighty voice, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. And when he uses repetition, fallen, fallen. In other words, God's judgment on him is sure. There's no question about it. It's going to happen. And it says, she has become a dwelling place of demons and of a prison of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. And like I said, that represents all the demonic influences that are going to be centered in this particular city. It's going to become the hubbub of not just materialism and sensuality, but also of occultism, of demon worship. And he also says that for all the nations have drunk of the wine of passion of immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by her wealth of her sensuality. Like I said, this isn't dealing with sex here. This is dealing with what? Spiritual adultery. He said all the people of the earth are seduced by what? Okay? The lure of money. And how often do Christians find themselves in that same situation where money becomes more important to them than their relationship with God? He says, and I heard a voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her sins, that you may not receive her plagues. And here God gives them a warning here, okay? This is during the tribulation period. These are the people who accept Christ during that time, okay, that seven-year span. And there's people living in this city. Okay, so let's face it, the lure of money, it's going to be there. But God gives them one warning. He says, if you don't get out of that city, you're going to receive her plagues. And I think that's a warning to us, too, that we need to separate ourselves from the values of the world, especially in regards to the love of money. And it says, for her sins have piled up high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. We are told in James 5, chapter 5, it says, come now, you rich, and weep and wail for your hour and your misery which are coming upon you. And he goes on to say that it's in the last days that you've set aside for yourself all this wealth. You know, at the turn of the century, we may have had just a handful of millionaires. Well, here it is. At the close of the century, we've got so many millionaires you can't count them all. Now there's billionaires more and more billionaires becoming prominent. But what's happening is that, you know, the rich are becoming richer and the poor are becoming poorer and the middle class is losing ground more and growing more ground, right? Well, this is going to be epitomized in the tribulation period, and it's going to be epitomized in this city where masses of humanity are going to be starving and living in abject squalor and misery. But at the same token, there's going to be these money makers who are going to be taking advantage of the situation and make all the money they can, you know, through it and because of it. And then God says that he, in that chapter 18, says, pay her back even as she has paid, and give her back double according to her deeds. I think it's kind of interesting that in the Old Testament, it was an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, bone for bone, break for break, right? Life for life. Okay? Well, now, this is vengeance. I mean, God, people say in the Old Testament, it's eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, and people think, well, gee, we don't want to live under that kind of condition because that's too cruel, that's too inhumane. But in actuality, the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, bone for bone, break for break, life for life was actually God's way of keeping men from overstepping bounds. In other words, it was almost like ironclad safeguards that keep men from vengeance. Okay? If a person, you lost your hand because of a person, you know, he had to lose his hand. But human nature would be, well, take his life or take both of his hands or whatever. But, you know, there was a situation where actually it was a restraint. Well, here, God says pay her back double, so you see a situation that now this is no longer just judgment. This is vengeance. Because God says, vengeance is mine, says the Lord, and I will repay. And, you know, all of the... Can you just imagine all the sins that have ever been committed, all the murders, all the thefts, all the crimes, everything that's ever been committed since the beginning of mankind because of money? All the lying, all the cheating, all the deceiving, all the... Can you imagine? It says that their sins have piled high to heaven because of this. You see, that's why this is what Zechariah sees as far as this woman in the Ephah. And she's going forth to Babylon. And that's where she's going to meet her doom. Interesting thing about what's described also in Revelation 18, it says that in 1 hour she shall be made desolate, suddenly, completely, in 1 hour. How many times did we read that? We must have read that at least a minimum of three times. Three times in that 18th chapter of Revelation, it said that in one hour, she will be destroyed. What would do that?
Wrath of God.
But we have. I think it's kind of significant. For example, I wrote some details down here. like the London fire, the Chicago fire, when Rome burned, all these different great disasters of the past, a lot of these destructive things that happened took days and days and days, and sometimes weeks, before they were finally put to an end. Okay? Well, this massive city is going to be destroyed in 1 hour. Okay? To me, what I see is going to happen, and this is speculative on my part, but what's going to happen is she's going to be hit with a nuclear atomic weapon. And why? Because it says all the merchants are standing back on their ships, and they don't go near her because of fear of her torment. And they're weeping and they're wailing and they're throwing dust into their hair and just crying because why? They've lost all their wealth. But they don't go near her because he's saying that she's being burned with fire. The smoke of her torment is going up. No one goes close to her because what? They're afraid of her destruction. What it describes there is nuclear destruction is going to happen to this Babylon. It says that an angel comes down from heaven. And he cast, we read it in 19, he cast her like a big, huge millstone into the bottom of the sea. What did Jesus say about millstones?
Talked about being tied around a man.
Yeah.
It would be better for a man to have a millstone around his neck
than
to hurt children.
In other words, to cause another person's little child to stumble into sin. If a person causes a little child to stumble into sin, he says, it's better for that person to have a millstone tied upon her neck and be cast in the depths of the sea than to lead another person into sin. Well, here we got this millstone. This has become the stumbling block of the world in terms of, you know, money. I'll give you an example. I mean, it's so obvious. There was a big article last week in the USA Today about how there's so many people now who are getting into the business of pornography on the internet because it's such a moneymaker. And they had this big article about this one woman who's gotten into it. She used to be an ex-stripper, and she's into it, and she's saying, well, she's trying to make some money, put her kids through college, and she's a homemaker and this whole thing. And I'm thinking, here we go. Here we go, a situation, right, where people will do anything for money. And they don't care who to destroy, you know, and how many kids they destroy, or how many families they destroy, how many people they destroy, is the money. They can justify everything, anything, right? Mm-hmm. That's just one tiny example. You know, you could use drugs, you could use pornography, you can use so many things to show the bottom line is what? Money, 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 money. Right? Mm-hmm. I don't care what it is, you can always justify it and rationalize and excuse it. Okay? Anyway, this millstone, he says it's cast into the sea. Now, I don't know if you can see this very well, but if you look up here, this is Babylon, way up here. Okay? And the sea, the Persian Gulf, is way down here, hundreds of miles here, this way. So you wonder, how has it ended up in the sea? Well, quite frankly, it's at the very, very end of the tribulation period. And we are told that there is tremendous world upheavals and destruction, and every island is brought low, every mountain is brought low, every island is moved out of its place. It's my contention, and I could be wrong, but there's going to be the geography, topography of the world is going to be changed at that particular time because of the natural disasters, and this whole thing is just going to be buried under the sea. Like everybody keeps talking about how California is going to drop off in the sea. How many times have you heard that? Well, I think this is going to be what's going to go into the sea. It's right here. This is going to be actually covered up by the Persian Gulf. Mm-hmm. Okay? And I think it's kind of significant that the sea symbolizes the sure and complete destruction of Babylon. No more music, no more workers, no more machinery, no more light, no more happiness. She becomes a dark, joyless, and silent monument to the uttermost vengeance of God. And I just put down here, at some places in the sea, the depth is over 7 miles deep. Where the pressure is so great, it would virtually crush almost anything, and it's actually about 5 degrees Fahrenheit. In other words, it's freezing, but the water doesn't freeze because of the tremendous pressure. It's just black, it's cold, it's dark, it's silent. And that's what's going to happen to Babylon. That's going to be your judgment. And, you know, the list that they make here, I think is pretty significant, because the list that they bring forth is a list of things that are actually divided, okay, into various categories. It's like they're divided into lists of seven, right? If you read it, I don't want to go through the whole list again, but if you look at it, it is kind of significant because it basically covers everything in terms of material things. Like if you go back, right, verse 11, it says that the merchants of the earth weep and wail over. And then verse 12 says, cargoes of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet. So what you're seeing here is you're seeing combinations of four sevens, all listed. You know, the building materials as far as gold, as precious stones, and as far as foods, as far as clothing, right? These are the things. Look at the clothing industry, all right? This is something that really projects the world. It's no longer simply a matter of what? Clothing to keep warm, something practical, but clothing has become what? It becomes almost like, if you look at this, who's that guy? Was Casey, whatever name it was killed with all of his designs, that homosexual.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, if you ever look at these pictures or these newsreels of these women going up and down the runway and all of their, I mean, they're gaudy stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just not worldly. Look at the crap that they wear. I mean, some of it's just absolutely astronomical.
You don't ever see that anywhere.
Okay, but this is what I mean. This epitomizes it, right? Okay, there's certainly nothing wrong with, you know, going out and buying clothes and having nice things. But what I'm talking about here, okay, I'm talking about, you know, this becoming an obsession. Clothing, material things, gold, silver, stones, precious, these things like this, right? Remember back in Babylon when Belshazzar was having his drunken orgy, they were toasting the gods of silver and gold and brass and wood and all of these different things, right? This is what men look to as far as their being their God. It's clothing, it's money, it's material things, it's food. Okay? These are things. And then the last thing he lists there, almost separate from all the others, he says, and human lives. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of significant because, you know, not only are we talking about a situation where abortion mills are in the process of making all of this money, and this is what, you know, one of the motivating things behind it, but also now we're getting into what. Harvesting the dead, really. China's already doing it in the sense that they're harvesting the dead. In other words, they're killing off so many of their prisoners. Why? Because they know that there's an enormous demand for organs throughout the world. So they get a blood type, a blood match, or whatever, and they say, oh, you need a kidney? This guy's got his kidney. They put a bullet in his head. They take out his kidney. They sell it to him. This is what China's been doing for a long time now. Okay? Well, this is going to be epitomized in the city. Okay? We're doing it now with unborn children. Okay? Well, it's going to be a situation where it's all going to come down to that. I know we've covered an awful lot of ground. Anybody have anything want to share, anything want to add? Because, like I said, this was a tough chapter to tackle simply because we got so little time to do it justice. But do you see... basically the connection between Zechariah's vision and what's going to take place in the last days. Does anybody have anything you want to add to it?
Well,